I'm Janet Forrest, and this is the Nantucket Athenaeum Podcast. In this season of the podcast, my colleague James Greeter and I are going to take you on a journey through time. You'll find out about the faces and frivolities that graced, or maybe disgraced, the stage of the Great Hall. You'll meet musicians, lecturers, and illusionists, some of repute and some, well, not. Who were these folks that made the long 30-mile trek to Nantucket, and how were they received by the islanders? Welcome to Tonight in Athenaeum Hall. This is Episode 4, Panoramas. On Monday, March 26th, 1849, the following announcement appeared in the Enquirer and Mirror under special notices.
The Mammoth Panorama of the Mississippi and Ohio Rivers will be open on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday afternoon of this week at the Athenaeum Hall. This gigantic painting passes over a country of 2,300 miles in extent from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to New Orleans, Louisiana. Admittance 25 cents. Doors open at 7 o'clock. Panorama moves at 7 and a half o'clock on Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Liberal arrangement made with schools.
Okay, James, last time we talked about the impresarios of the stage, and this week we're going to talk about panoramas, and there is a bit of overlap. So just give us some context, tell us what they are and what we can expect.
Sure. As you mentioned in the last episode, we talked about these impresarios of the stage, whether they be quick change artists, ventriloquists, magicians, who would often incorporate, as they do today, props into their acts. And sometimes that would include things like staging, including scenery like a panorama behind them. The panorama might be the primary sort of mover of whatever, wherever they were going. And along with the panorama would come a magician or ventriloquist, a singing family, and they would kind of build a little act around what was this really massive structure or massive object that was traveling around the country. And these were the panoramas that we mentioned briefly at the opening. People are probably familiar with panoramas like panorama setting on their phone for their camera, meaning like a wide, all-encompassing view of something, whether it's scenery, like a landscape. Panoramas in this sense are paintings. There were massive artworks for the most part, and they would often have a particular theme, like a military battle or historic event. And due to the size of them, of these panoramas, they were typically displayed in rotundas for the viewing so that you would enter through a long, dark tunnel. And what was very important with these was that you did not see this edge of the screen. And so they would place plants and objects, sometimes it was like a horse. They would put everything, whatever they could, in front of it to create the illusion of depth and seamlessness between what you were experiencing and your and the viewer. And it was kind of like people today coming out of IMAX and saying, there's that syndrome with Pandora from the movie that came out recently, I can't remember the name, where people feel like they were in a different world and they're sad that they had to come back. And that was the experience that they were going for with these panoramic exhibitions. Very popular in 19th century Europe and the U.S. They started to decline in the latter third of the 19th century, but here in the U.S., there was a bit of a revival. They were more commonly known by that point as a cyclorama. So if you've ever been to Gettysburg, they have that very large cyclorama that's there in the main sort of rotunda depicting Pickett's charge at the Battle of Gettysburg. So they're obviously not something that was very easy to take on the road. People would go to the city to go and see the panorama. Now, that being said, there were smaller panoramas that were simply very large paintings, not of the extreme size of the ones that would be displayed in a rotunda. They would be more like a large painting with various scenes painted on it. So, for example, in 1855, there was a panorama of the American Revolution that was brought to the Athenaeum, and it featured different battles and different scenes. It wasn't meant to be seen as one large picture that was a coherent image. It was more telling the story of the American Revolution. And as the paper notes, quote, "The more revolting features of war, even under the mildest forms, are avoided in this painting as far as possible and still give faithful representations. So again, appropriate for all audiences. That's kind of what they were going for. They wanted it to be a family experience where you could bring everybody with you. And it wasn't that it wasn't simply like a shock horror kind of experience of these battles, because some of these depictions were in fact terrifying to experience. And I'll get into that a little bit later on. Again, the main point was absolutely immersing the audience to the point where they couldn't tell the difference between the canvas and reality. And that was actually one of the problems that people had with panoramas. So that it was basically just propaganda, that it was an illusion that was meant to deceive, specifically to deceive, and people objected to that aspect of it. Also, romantics really, really hated panoramas, apparently. When I say romantics, I mean members of the romantic movement, because what they objected to about it was that panoramas depicting, for example, topographical scenes like mountain views and things, they made the sublime accessible to every person with a few pennies in their pocket. And then the sublime became just an everyday commodity without any real value. By associating the sublime with the material, panoramas were seen as a threat to romanticism. William Wordsworth wrote about it in one of his stories, and he flat out objected to link materiality and the sublime in this way that sort of diminished this experience for romantics.
Well, something I almost think about is if you go to a museum, I lived in New York briefly and would go to MoMA, and very few people are walking around just enjoying the paintings. Everyone has their phone out, and it almost diminishes the experience. I wonder if that's kind of a similar, or you think of a postcard, like, oh, that you look at a beautiful vista and you're like, it looks like a postcard. It's like, no, the postcard looks like the vista.
That's a great, great example, I think, of exactly his point. Yeah, that experience of this amazing view was reduced in our minds to a postcard, to the point where we maybe now reference that as the object, as opposed to the, yes, Shelley is probably rolling in his grave at this point, you know, at the way that we've diminished the sublime with our culture. That would be, he would be if it weren't already filled with George Gordon, Lord Byron. So it's probably pretty crowded in there. So eventually, though, two things. One, the larger panoramas could not take with you on the road, as I mentioned before, which means that after a while, people just get used to it. And it's like, well, everybody that's going in the city that's going to come see the panorama has come, and then people stop showing up, and then it loses money. So what they came up with, which were particularly popular here in the U.S., were moving panoramas. And these were, you probably had one as a kid, you would turn the little knob and the scene would move by you, and it would be a chase scene or horses or something.
Yeah.
So this is essentially that, but the size of the stage at the Athenaeum. It was a canvas that would scroll on these two enormous spools past the viewer. It originated in Scotland in the early 19th century. They would take a long, continuous painted canvas scene. The canvas, as I said, would scroll across the back of the stage behind a stationary object. As I mentioned before, it could be a boat if it's an ocean voyage, and one of them is, there was one that we're going to mention coming up. It could be a horse. And when I say horse, I don't mean a stuffed horse. I mean an actual horse. Now, here at the Athenaeum, probably hard to get a horse up the stairs.
Even harder to get them down.
Yeah. But some of the theaters, like the Bowery Theater, had these elaborate presentations with like boats and things on floating in actual water. I mean, it must have been a remarkable thing to experience. The fact that they were on these enormous spooling scrolls, even though they were bulky and they'd have to be shipped from place to place, they were a step up from the viewing the panorama at a rotunda. And they were the kind of the precursor to moving pictures. In fact, they were the original moving pictures, in that they were pictures that moved. And for the first time, they could have things like traveling motion portrayed in this presentation. So they could have chase sequences, create a more mobile effect. Now, the other thing about the moving panorama as opposed to the stationary panorama was the moving panorama always had a narrator who was called Professor oftentimes, and he would describe the scenes as they passed and add to the drama of what people were experiencing, because a lot of the times it was, you wouldn't necessarily know what you were looking at. In fact, one of the most successful of them was a man named John Bavard, who created a panorama of a trip up and down the Mississippi River he made so much money that he built what was called Bonvard's Folly, which is on Long Island. Maybe you've heard of it, the enormous castle that was built there in imitation of Windsor Castle, bankrupted him. And it's, I think it's a national park today, but he made his money off of these moving panoramas. He was the first painter to undertake a panorama of that size. And it was noted, according to critics, that it was the accuracy and the sheer spectacle of this Mississippi River panorama earned him much of his fame. And indeed, here on Nantucket in 1849, in March, the Manus Panorama of the Mississippi and Ohio Rivers, which passed over 2,300 miles of the country that was then growing at the time from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to New Orleans, Louisiana. And seems like it might have been his, but it's hard to say because there were a lot of these things going around. Once one would become successful, somebody would knock off another one, inevitably, probably not as good quality to it, but they knew that the fame of that presentation would draw people to go see theirs as well. So there were a series of them that actually passed through the Athenaeum's doors that people were able to check out. There was a panorama of Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, where the artist apparently descended into the cave to recreate this experience. The cave was illuminated by all these lamps and torches that allowed him to capture the cavern with a lot of fidelity and realism, so that, again, as you viewed this, as you were viewing it as an audience member, you felt like you were actually descending into this cave. Some of them were not, though, sort of nature-oriented like that or travel-oriented. There was one that was a panorama of the creation and the Garden of Eden, so that you would see the entire story of Genesis or Exodus on display as it would scroll past you. Another nature tour that was offered was a grand tour of the Great Lakes. It was called Purim's 7-Mile Mirror, and it was the creation of a man named Josiah Purim, who was from Maine. He made a huge fortune as a storekeeper and a manufacturer of woolen socks. Soon lost that through bad investment, and then moved to Boston, where he accumulated enough money to pay off his creditors, and then went on to with this brand new idea of this enormous moving panorama. He bought a smaller one in 1850 and established it in Boston, and then went on from that project. He seemed like the kind of person that would go from project to project, idea to idea. So once he started his magic mirror on its tour, basically, it seemed like he lost interest in that, became much more interested in the railroads, and again lost all of his money and ended up penniless. But his panorama continued to tour the country regardless, under the auspices of somebody else. He eventually died in extreme poverty, but to his credit, he did have a city in Minnesota named after him as a result of his work with the railroads. He achieved a kind of lasting fame, I guess, with that.
That's funny, because it was the which of the Family Singers has a town in Minnesota named?
Yes, the Hutchinsons.
It sounds like everyone just ends up in Minnesota with the town named after them.
Yeah, that's right. It's a good point. Yeah, if you get lucky enough to get out to Minnesota, you might have your own town named after you. What a time to be alive. And as I mentioned earlier, some of them also had more of a theological or an instructional aspect to them, where they were teaching a lesson about the Garden of Eden and the early stories of Exodus and Genesis, and that were, I guess, a bit more lurid in some ways because of the illustrations involved with that. As time passed, and again, as happened with the other panoramas, the ones in the rotundas, after a while, people get kind of jaded about what they're seeing, kind of say, what else you got? And so one of the ones that did appear here on Nantucket at the Athenaeum was not only the panorama of the Crystal Palace of London, but they also had another panorama, a smaller one, of the yacht America, which had just won the America's Cup for the first time. So there was, here's one panorama, here's another panorama, here's Miss Ella Lee, she's a vocalist, she's going to sing. Here's Professor Daniels, the renowned wizard and ventriloquist. Here's Mr. Lyman, the unrivaled banjo player. So like they kept adding things to the act to kind of bring more people in and to liven it up, because these tour the country incessantly, and some of them after a while looked a bit worse for wear.
On that note of them being a little worse for the wear, what were these made out of? What was the material?
They were cloth or canvas. And in fact, because of that, the delicate nature of the material and the fact that they traveled and were used so extensively, there are very few of them left in existence today, and to restore them would be enormously expensive. I just wanted to add one more other of the delineators, the speakers.
Yes, please.
One of the panoramas that was portrayed in 1855 featured multiple panoramas. There was the Mammoth Cave we talked about before, but also Niagara Falls, and he filled the place not because of the material, but because of the speaker himself. His name was Rufus Somerby, and he was a showman of the First Order, one of the very few men of his possession who actually left behind any memoirs, so we know quite a bit about him. He's chiefly known through a series of articles that he wrote in the Billboard, which was the ancestor of today's Billboard magazine. That at the time was a trade journal for circus, carnival, and theatrical performers and managers. He operated several moving panoramas under the management of a theater in Boston, including a panorama of Dr. Kane's Arctic voyages. And the way that he would relay these stories was very impressive. There's a picture of him on his Wikipedia entry. He's very, he looks like the kind of guy that you would want to have, a carnival barker almost. He's got a big Stetson hat on, a large duster, kind of a larger than life figure. He brought a bit of razzmatazz to what was probably a bit of a tattered panorama by that point. In fact, one of them, which came up previously, was the burning of Moscow, which was a very famous one. Again, spawned a lot of imitators. It appears that we had one of the imitators that arrived here in Nantucket. The original was very impressive. It was a large canvas scroll that would gradually unroll, and it would show Napoleon's arrival in Moscow. And surrounding the diorama, the panorama, were dioramas of buildings with troops and civilians that would slide into place back and forth as the events moved along. And then he also had the din of war, as they called it at the time, produced by machines. He had a musket machine that had 12 springs that would fire off the muskets all at once, cannon drums, pots of burning charcoal, candlesticks with springs. Amidst all of that, you had all of these young kids that he would hire to actually work all of this stuff, firing all of these things off. So the side effect of this was that a lot of these places burned down because of the fire involved and the flammable material that was involved, and the fact that it was kids that were often operating them. And the one that came here, the diorama of Moscow, seems like it was not any great shakes by comparison. Maybe not a lot of that, the flash in the pan kind of stuff, because the paper goes on to talk about, by the way, there were two papers at the time. There was the INM and there was the Nantucket Weekly Mirror. And the Weekly Mirror said, "We understand that there was a kind of exhibition at the Athenaeum Hall," this is in 1854, "on Wednesday and Thursday evenings." I'm going to use my voice for the italics because there are a lot of them in this next sentence. "We infer from the silent testimony of those supposed to be the most intimately acquainted with its real merits that those who were absent saved their money." So they were emphasizing that basically this was a bit of a scam. They would take your money at the door, you get inside and find out there was not much to it. And in fact, the gentleman who brought this particular diorama down to Nantucket was known for this. And there were other instances of him on the East Coast, essentially booking the show, getting the advertising in place, showing up for one night, collecting some money, staying as long as he could, and then splitting and leaving town and not paying any of the creditors who he owed. Kind of like with some other art forms too, perhaps you might see that where they became a much more common event, much more common experience, and then became a little bit tawdry, a little bit cheap, and so lost a lot of its favor. And that's why a lot of them just were not preserved, because they weren't valued as an artifact. Now, that being said, there is a remarkable one at the New Bedford Whaling Museum that is called A Whaling Voyage Around the World that they bought, I think, in like 1908, and was just kind of sitting in their storage cupboard. It was very expensive, and they went through a restoration process about 10 years ago now. And you can see the entire thing on YouTube. They've put up a video where you can watch the entire scroll and get a sense anyway of what that must have been like to see that at the time. Again, it's a little bit different seeing it on our little screens now, but these are, when you stand in front of this panorama, this scene, it's remarkable. The size of the canvas is 10 feet tall, and the length of it, they've said, was close to the size of the Empire State Building in height. So very, very long piece of fabric, and you can see why that would be very hard to preserve over a long period of time, especially when it gets a lot of heavy use.
Yeah, and kind of like what we talked about last time with the magicians, this was stuff that people hadn't seen before. So many people have gone to a museum or you've seen large murals, or you even think of, you know, graffiti and street art in cities that you see these huge murals. It's not that, you know, it's beautiful and I appreciate it, but it doesn't have that same sense of wonder as something, wow, I've never seen anything like this.
Exactly. It was, yeah, we miss a little bit some of the novelty of these things. And also that people at the time weren't saturated with information about the outside world. We try to escape that now. As with the Lyceum movement, there was a real hunger, especially on the part of Americans in the mid-19th century, to know more about the world and our place in it as a nation. And so they were hungry for whatever representation of that they could get, whether it be a speaker who would come and talk about their experiences traveling around the world, or a moving panorama that would actually show them what they were not able to go see on their own. And so could be used as learning tools for bringing an experience to people that are stuck on an island out in the middle of the ocean. As with everything else, they had their sort of less positive uses, I guess you could say, in the ways that they were used to propagandize ideas or beliefs. It was a very powerful visual medium that we still wrestle with today when we talk about access to information online, where what are people seeing? What are they experiencing? How are they getting this information? What is the context for that information? And how are they applying that to themselves in their daily lives?
Now, it seems like the heyday of the panoramas, correct me if I'm wrong, was sort of the mid-1800s. And this would have been leading up to the Civil War. I'm not sure if you have an answer to this, but what impact did the Civil War have on not just the panoramas, but the impresarios, the people that were performing?
Many of them continued to perform. The impresarios would continue to perform around the country. Some of them would go to work in various capacities for the government, traveling around and performing for troops, just like the USO does today. You're absolutely right. And especially with the panoramas, that is very much a sort of an 1830s to 1860s timeframe. And I think it's just because people had kind of been there, done that in part. It was kind of an old thing. Oh, yeah, my parents like going to the panorama, you know. But I love those new, that new family of singers. Man, they're something. So, yeah, my understanding of it is that by the time the Civil War came, things were so different. Both we had the railroads in place at that point. People could actually go and make these journeys themselves. And so that's when you really start to see the rise in tourism as an industry. And there's a great book called Inventing New England about the first tourist trade, which was the White Mountains of New Hampshire, where they were literally still colonizing and building towns as tourists were showing up to see these quaint little rustic towns. So people had much more mobility at that point and were able to go and travel and see Niagara Falls, whereas that would have been a very arduous journey 20 or 30 years prior to that.
And one more question. We talked about a couple examples, but where do you see the impresarios and the panoramas showing up in modern culture?
I think in particular, well, I mean, obviously we still have ventriloquists and magicians, although they, as I said before, they tend to kind of specialize in their own particular type of entertainment. Whereas before there was more going on with a blending of the different experiences or acts. Same thing with quick change artists. You don't see that as much today, but you do see character actors and character sketches, people performing on stage as characters. The panorama, I think the closest analogy might be the IMAX in some ways, in that it's meant to be an all-encompassing sensory experience where you're literally in the picture, as it were. So I think the experience is still there. The format's changed a little bit. We obviously have talkies now as well. That makes a big difference when it comes to going to see a movie. So they're still there in spirit, if not in actuality. I think what unites all of these, whether it be the performers, the impresarios, or it's the panoramas, they were all about a hunger to know more about the world and about this new country that we were creating at the time that didn't really have its own character or identity. And all we really had to go on was Europe for the most part and our understanding of what was cultural or culturally appropriate, perhaps, for its citizens. And this was the beginning of establishing our own national identity, our own national culture, and presages the entertainment behemoth that American entertainment and culture has become in the 20th century and 21st century.
This has been a production of the Nantucket Athenaeum. It was hosted and edited by me, Janet Forrest. Special thanks to Reference Library Associate James Greeter for his knowledge and research. The opening announcement was voiced by Andrew Cromartie. Please check the show notes for more information and references. You can find all the previous episodes of this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. If you have an idea for what we should talk about next, send us an email at jforrest@nantucketathenaeum.org. The Nantucket Athenaeum is located at 1 India Street in Nantucket, Massachusetts. We would love for you to stop by. You can find us online at nantucketathenaeum.org or search at Nantucket Athenaeum on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening. And if you love this episode, share it with a friend.